It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today we meet the family responsible for the espresso machine and the man who heads the family's coffee dynasty in Italy. He's Dr. Ernesto Ely, and he's going to tell us how a single cup of espresso reveals some of the keys to the unique Italian mind. Speaking of family, Jane and Michael Stern are eating at Mr. Perkins' Family Restaurant in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We've got the answer to which kind of turkey to buy. The editor of Cook's Illustrated magazine reports on their turkey taste test. Then it's to Appalachia for a historian's take on a local class controversy, cornbread versus biscuits. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. This is the time of year a lot of us bake. In fact, for most of us, it's the only time of year we bake, or the only time of year we try baking from scratch. So I thought some baking tips might be in order. If you remember only one thing from this chronicle, file away this idea. You can freeze most cookie and pie doughs. This means you can make up batches whenever you have a free hour, freeze them, then set aside a Sunday to bake off everything. Okay, let's start with talking about cakes. When baking cakes, always have all your ingredients at room temperature. This room temperature business really is important in recipes that call for creaming or beating the butter until it's fluffy, then adding the sugar, the eggs, and the dry ingredients. This style of cake will be vastly improved, lighter, and more velvety if you're sure to have the butter at room temperature. That's between 65 and 70 degrees, and you can tell if you just stick an instant reading thermometer in your butter. Also, make sure you beat the butter at medium speed, never high speed. The reason temperature and speed make such a difference is that the whole structure of this kind of cake is determined by how much volume you get when you beat the butter. At 65 to 70 degrees, the butter is elastic enough to beat up to maximum volume with lots of air pockets. If it's too warm, those air pockets collapse. Medium speed makes those air pockets big and stable. When you mix in the other ingredients, do it gently so the batter stays light and airy. And by the way, if you've got a cookie recipe that calls for creaming the butter and the sugar, these same rules apply. Cookie recipes vary a lot, so always read through the whole recipe before you start baking. Okay, now let's get on to pies. With pie doughs, you want all the ingredients cold. I mean really cold. I usually cut up whatever kind of fat I'm using and tuck it in the freezer along with the flour. You give them 30 minutes, then you make the pie dough. The next step in pie dough is mix the dry ingredients and work in the fat. Now, there's another trick here. If you keep the butter in big 1-inch flakes as you work it into the dry ingredients, your crust will be flaky. If you work the butter in more so that the mixture looks like coarse cornmeal, the crust will be more like a cookie. Now it's time to add the liquid to the dough. And here's where you can determine if the crust is going to be tender or tough. Just remember this. Don't overmix. It's okay if the mixture looks rough and clumpy. As long as it holds together when you gather it into a ball, you're fine. And whenever you work your pie dough, like mixing it or rolling it out, give it a rest in the refrigerator. Just wrap it up, chill it, and leave it there for about 30 minutes or more. Do these things and you will always get a tender pie crust. Now let's talk about baking the pie. How to keep it from getting a soggy bottom, which is the bane of almost every pie I can think of. Now, if I'm doing a single crusted pie, like a pumpkin pie, I always pre-bake the bottom crust. You just line it with foil, Fill the foil with dried beans and bake it at the bottom of the oven until the crust is firmed up and looks dry. It's not completely baked, but it's just about halfway. It takes about 10 minutes at 400 degrees. Some other ways to ensure not having a soggy bottom crust is to brush it with egg white or jam or melted chocolate just before you add the filling. Just one other really important thing to remember whenever you bake. Never substitute margarine for butter. Margarine has more water than butter, not to mention nowhere near the great taste. So forget the margarine and stick with the unsalted butter. Here's a quick wrap-up. Make pie and cookie doughs ahead and freeze them. Have your butter at room temperature for cakes and ice cold for pie crusts. And join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by the kitchenware area at Target, offering the latest assortment of tea kettles with flip-up whistles, 1810 stainless steel exteriors, and heat-resistant handles. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI Public Radio International. Today, we talk espresso. No one makes coffee like the Italians. You watch a barista make a cup of coffee in a coffee bar there, and it's performance art and craft all tied together, and it's delicious. But the big question is, why Italy? Coffee beans don't grow there, so why is coffee so important there? We've got some interesting answers to this one from Dr. Ernesto Ely. He's the head of an Italian family that's built an empire on coffee. He's going to explain Italy's coffee culture, and he's going to tell us what a really fine cup of espresso should taste like. Are you in the midst of the annual turkey quandary? Which kind to buy? Fresh, frozen, basted, brined? Well, worry no more. We've got the answer. Christopher Kimball, editor of Cook's Illustrated magazine, reports on their turkey taste test. We're going to Ketchum, Idaho, not to ski, but for a Basque sheep festival. Evidently, Idaho used to be the world's second largest sheep producer. Well, the sheep are making a comeback. From Appalachia, we have the story of cornbread, biscuits, and feminism. Then, as always, in the second half of the show, we will be opening the lines for your calls. That number's 800-537-5252. Well, Jane and Michael Stern are ready to get things rolling. They write the road food column in Gourmet Magazine. Jane, Michael, I am heading for Wisconsin this weekend, and I need some advice. Where should I eat?
Oh, you are so lucky. Michael and I just got back from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And if you have only one place to eat there, go to Mr. Perkins Family Restaurant for the best soul food in all of the state.
Willie Jr., the son of the proprietor, told us what's special about this place.
Family-oriented, home cooking, been in business for 31 years now.
And what are some of the specialties here?
Wow, baked chicken and dressing, smothered steak, peach cobbler. During the season, we have fried green tomatoes. People love that. We have fried corn cut off the cob. People enjoy that during the season also. Cakes, pies, things like that.
Tell us about the cornbread here.
We make it up in bulk. We fry it on the grill, fry it to order. That way it's fresher and it has a better flavor. It's made basically like you'd make at home, except for the fact we do it to order. It's fresher that way.
Is that, what do they mean on the grill? Is it like a pancake, guys?
Yes, exactly. It's like a cornmeal pancake, not a cakey square of cornbread. And every single thing that we saw being served at Mr. Perkins Family Restaurant looked better than the next. There probably were, 12 different kinds of vegetables, 3 different kinds of entree meats, 5 different kinds of cakes, and just whatever was coming out of the kitchen, from fried perch in the sandy cornmeal crust to something that Michael and I wouldn't normally order, like neck bones, pig neck bones, just looked so sumptuous. I guess also anything sided by ooey gooey yams and fried green tomatoes in, you know, this perfectly, you know, sort of brittle crust that just breaks when your fork touches it. I mean, what could be wrong about that?
He also makes something that I've never seen on any other menu. He has turnip greens. He also makes a dish called turnip bottoms, which are not the turnips themselves, but they're the part of the turnip between the turnip and the green. And he mashes these up with butter and sugar and makes a kind of casserole out of them that is absolutely delicious. Not at all like squash. It looks like squash, but it has a taste unlike anything I've ever eaten.
Are we talking the stems of the greens? I mean, between the greens and the turnip is a stem.
It's a stem. And he somehow makes these stems into something that is just so rich and luscious you can't believe it. It really is better than any vegetable should be.
I think my absolute favorite dish that I had at Mr. Perkins was baked chicken and homemade dressing, you know, or stuffing if you're a northerner, because it came with not only these fabulous corn cakes, but it came with homemade pear preserves that they put up at the restaurant and serve in a little bowl on the side. And these are almost like candied pear slices, but with cloves in them. It's almost like a candied apple slice, but it's pear, and it is so luscious and rich, which didn't at all stop me from ordering their homemade pineapple coconut cake for dessert.
Well, Jane had coconut cake, but I had to have the individually sized fried peach pie for my dessert.
The other thing that if you ever go to a good soul food restaurant like Mr. Perkins, you cannot go wrong getting is macaroni and cheese. I've never quite figured out what they do with macaroni and cheese in soul food restaurants that make it taste unlike anything that, you know, you think of macaroni and cheese as like school cafeteria fare. Well, this, I mean, aside from having probably a pound of cheese, you know, per every three noodles in it, which is the ratio that I like,
The texture is so wonderful.
It's like nursery food. It's very soft. And
no,
very,
but it also has like brittle parts too. It's got soft parts, but also those kind of crusty parts on the edge that are so good. Jane eats the middle and I eat the outside. This is why we get along so well.
Well, we kept ordering more food and more food and more food. And the only thing that we didn't fight over was chitlins, which is not my favorite part of the pig. And when we got the plate of fried chitlins, I just pushed it over to Michael and I said, "Here, dear. This is yours. You can have it all to yourself." But everything else we just fought over like cats and dogs.
Thank you both.
You're welcome. I hope you take a wonderful trip to Wisconsin, Lynn.
Happy eating.
We got more soul. We got more soul.
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Square Meals, America's Favorite Comfort Food Cookbook. Every week, they're here with their favorite food finds, and every week you can get their discoveries on our website at splendidtable.org. This is the week for the buying of the turkey and facing the big questions. Frozen, fresh, self-basting, free range. Well, we've got the last word on buying the bird. We have Christopher Kimball, editor and publisher of Cook's Illustrated magazine. Cook's accepts no advertising and they love to test. This month, they taste tested turkeys. Christopher Kimball, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So, Chris, what did you find out?
Well, as they said, I was shocked of the results. We thought a really expensive free-range bird would be the winner, wouldn't you?
I mean, well, yeah, I must confess, yes, exactly.
Yeah, and a frozen butterball wouldn't do too well. But it turns out a frozen butterball did better than a fresh butterball, did better than the premium, quote-unquote, free-range bird, which was shocking. It was the most interesting result we've ever had.
Brother. So how many turkeys did you test?
We did eight, and we roasted them the same way. You know, each package gives slightly different directions, but we decided it would be unwise to use different cooking methods, so we used the same method. And what was interesting was the real issue was brined birds or salted birds, like a kosher bird.
Mm-hmm. A bird that's soaked in salted water. That's what you mean by brining.
Yeah, those birds, even if they had been frozen, seemed to do better than birds in general, than birds that were not brined or salted.
So you're saying the cheap, self-basted frozen turkey is the turkey to look for.
Yeah, that's true. As a matter of fact, the brand that, quote-unquote, won the tasting was by far the least expensive at under a dollar a pound, 79 cents a pound. And it was one none of us had ever thought about buying. And it turned out, had clean flavor, succulent, flavorful, distinct, all the things you'd expect from the free-range bird. It was the one that won the day.
What was the name of it?
I knew you were going to ask me. It was the Marval, or M-A-R-V-A-L. Now, there is a caveat here, mm-hmm. which is that very often in tastings, people will select what they're used to from their childhood. And I think most of us are used to fairly bland commercial birds from the 50s, in my case, because I'm not old, but other people from the 60s and 70s. So I don't think we're used to the taste of a homegrown turkey. In fact, the editor who organized this tasting, she actually raised a turkey at her farm in New York State. She butchered it herself with her husband and brought it to work, plucked, and we roasted it. And it was the worst bird in terms of flavor. Now, that may be what she fed it, but it had a very gamey, almost seafood kind of flavor to it, which had a very sour note. So maybe Americans like fairly bland, innocuous turkey. They're really eating the stuffing and the gravy.
So the turkey is like the bruschetta, right? I mean, it's right. Just like a slice of bread, and it's carrying all the taste.
I was going to say veal, but bruschetta is even worse, yes. It's a carrier. That's right.
Well, now, what's in that self-basting bird?
Well, self-basting is kind of an interesting term. Basically, they have turkey broth in this one, salt, of course, sugar, and quote-unquote flavoring. So they use basically broth, sugar, and sometimes salt, always salt, sometimes some sugar and some additional quote-unquote flavoring.
Is there a little fat in there usually too?
Yeah. The fat is interesting. We did some research, and the fat, which could be butter or oil, stimulates your saliva glands and gives you the impression, even though there's only a small amount in there, that the bird is actually juicier than it is. So a little bit of fat helps. And the salt, the proteins in the muscles unravel in the presence of salt. They're denatured. Then they hook up, and they'll trap the water in the solution. So you end up with actually some water retention in the, especially the breast meat. So when you slice into it after it's roasted, it actually is, you know, physically juicier.
So the salt from the self-basted bird or from a brined bird is actually making it juicier because it's holding more water.
Yeah, if you just soaked a turkey in water, you wouldn't have much of an effect. If you soak it in salted water, and by the way, if you want to do this at home, you could take 2 gallons of water and you take 1 cup of table salt and soak it in like a beer cooler overnight with some ice packs for about 12 hours and then rinse it off and dry it and roast it. You can also do that in 4 hours, but you'd use more salt. So you'd use 2 cups of table salt for 2 gallons of water instead of 1 cup, and then rinse it off, then dry it, and go ahead and roast it. But the salt will actually, as I said, unwind those proteins that are coiled up, then they sort of hook up together, and in between, it's sort of like a mesh, they will trap the water, and you'll end up actually with more water in the bird.
So take a styrofoam cooler, put ice packs in it, 2 cups of salt to 2 gallons of water, immerse the turkey in that, keep it stone cold, though.
You want to keep it cold. The key is not to let it sit at over 40 degrees.
Right.
40 degrees is the temperature at which, if there is bacteria on the turkey to start with, where it would start to multiply.
Okay, so either buy frozen self-basting or brine it yourself. Hey, Chris, happy Thanksgiving.
You too. Take care.
Christopher Kimball is publisher and editor of Cook's Illustrated Magazine. Their turkey tasting article is in the November-December issue. Now, we've posted the names of their top 3 birds on our website, along with my recipe for 3-generation Thanksgiving turkey. You can find that and everything you need at the Splendid Table website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the family that gave us the espresso machine, a Basque sheep festival in Idaho, and of course your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. Although espresso has become almost as ubiquitous as McDonald's for us here in America, the best espresso is still made in Italy. So if we're going to learn about it, we should go to an Italian expert. Dr. Ernesto Ely heads up one of Italy's coffee dynasties. His family started working with coffee in 1935 in Trieste, that's just east of Venice. The firm is still based there, and it's still family-run. Dr. Ely, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
How did your family get started in the coffee business?
My father was fighting World War I with the Hungarian army on the Carso. And he met my mother, who was born in Johannesburg, South Africa, and carried to Trieste when she was a child. And they fell in love. So this is just a result of the war that is a cocktail shaker of human being. And I was born there just by pure accident.
You mean born in Trieste in northern Italy? Okay, all right. And then how did the coffee business come about?
My father began with a chocolate factory, but he was in love with the chocolate, with tea, and with coffee. And he was looking for perfection and hunting perfection all his life. And the first thing he did was to protect coffee from staining. Coffee is a chemical instable component, and in 1 or 2 weeks he will become totally rancid. By protecting coffee with vacuum, you eliminate the oxygen, but you do also a big error because you remove the volatile fraction of the aromas. My father applied vacuum and then counter pressure, positive pressure with nitrogen, which makes the coffee stable, but also fixes the flavors and the aromas into the oil fraction. And the oil is part of the espresso. Oil is the flavor carrier, and it sticks on your tongue, and it gives you the long aftertaste and afterflavor that makes an espresso wonderful if it's good quality, and torture if it is bad.
So your father originally developed this method with nitrogen to keep coffee beans, and then went on to actually perfect the making of espresso, have I understood you correctly?
He was the man that first applied two different sources of energy on the coffee during the percolation. In the old espresso machines, coffee was prepared with the hot water from a boiler and pushed out with the steam of the same boiler. But increasing the pressure, you increase the temperature and you make the coffee bitter and astringent. So my father said, I use a boiler for making the hot water and I use compressed air for pushing it out. And this was the beginning of the new revolution in which the modern espresso machine have developed. Today you can have a wonderful cup of espresso with the coffee prepared with hot water below boiling, controlled by a thermostat, and the water pressed by a little pump that raises the pressure to approximately 140 psi.
So there's no burning, and that's how you get that sweet, good flavor from that espresso.
You have this velvet structure, you know. A coffee espresso, when it is right, it's a caress on your tongue, and it sticks on your tongue, and it paints your tongue. And until your tongue is painted, it will give you the long-lasting aftertaste and afterflavor.
You know, I don't know how anyone can hear that and not smile. That makes me want to run out and get a good cup of espresso. But there's something I've always puzzled over. Coffee is not grown in Italy, but there's no other country in the world that I can think of that celebrates coffee, that has made coffee such an art. Why this incredible art developing in Italy, of all places?
You know, in Italy, we have a population that is strongly social. They love to have human contact, and one of the master of this human contact is the barista. If you enter in a bar, in a cafe in Italy, you will find the barista looking immediately in your eyes. He will remember your order, and it will be maybe a ristretto with a little foam on top with no sugar. You come there 1 or 2 weeks later, he will recognize you, smile, look in your eyes, and then again he will say, a ristretto with a little foam and no sugar. This is the art of the Italian barista. They are great technicians because they know how to make a wonderful cup of espresso, but they are also wonderful actors and people that love to have relationship with their brothers in the human race.
And this is the man who's standing behind the coffee bar actually making the coffee, and he's called the barista.
The barista is the man that is responsible for the 50% of the quality. The best beans become an excellent cup only if they are well prepared. A clean machine, a perfect grind, perfect tamping, perfect timing, perfect volume. So if you have all that, you have a small cup of espresso, maybe 30, 35 milliliters, less than 1.5 ounces, that is creamy, that is like a velvet, that contains a lot of flavor and taste, and very low amount of caffeine. Because contrary to what people believe, espresso contains a lot of flavor and a lot of taste, but the caffeine content is low. Approximately 60% of the caffeine that is in the ground coffee bed moves into the cup, and it is because the time of preparation is not longer than 30 seconds. If you prepare a cup of coffee in a filter, it takes 8 minutes, then you have all the caffeine that was in the ground coffee in the cup. In espresso, only approximately 60%. So this explains why the Italian can drink 6 or 8 or 10 cups of espresso without getting upset. And if they visit the States, they find this coffee so diluted, it's so beverage-like, and they drink 10 and they get shaky because the American coffee is not strong in taste and flavor, but it contains a lot of coffee.
Then can you tell us, if we don't have an espresso machine at home, how to make a good cup of coffee? Is that possible?
Walk to the next cafe nearby and have an espresso. There is no way to make a substitute to espresso.
Well, Doctor, I want to thank you. I have now, my image of espresso is that of a dream.
It is a dream, but it is also produced in dreams. Because, you know, caffeine is stimulating the fantasy and the so-called prefrontal cortex. It is the area where our imagination is meeting the reality of the moment with the experience we have in our long-term memory. And this is the place where the so-called aha sensation is happening. So have a nice espresso, and you will see that life is much better than without.
Dottore, grazie moltissimo.
E arrivederci.
Arrivederci. Dr. Ernesto Ely is chairman of Ely Coffee. So, Italy's the coffee capital. If I say beef, it's the United States, right? What about lamb? The Middle East? How about the state of Idaho? In 1918, more than 2.5 million sheep grazed in Idaho's mountain meadows. The state was second only to Australia in world sheep production. But Idaho lamb got pushed into the background with foreign imports, synthetic fibers, and new foods taking hold. Now, those Idaho ranchers still in business near the resort town of Ketchum want to show the wealthy newcomers, the resort people, their traditional way of life. So they put together a 3-day fall festival every year. It has an educational fair, a Basque lamb dinner, and something most newcomers have never seen, sheep trailing through the center of town. Jill Hoyt reports from Ketchum, Idaho.
A mule-drawn sheep herder's wagon makes its way down Ketchum's main street as men and women hoot, holler, and flail their arms trying to control a block-long flock of sheep. John Etchard is the foreman of Faulkner Land, Livestock, and Sheep.
Well, we need to show these people where the lamb comes from.
Unbothered by sheep droppings, the fleece-clad crowd lines both sides of Main Street, applauding as they celebrate the Old West.
This is a great time. Oh, it's just something you don't see every day. Feels like you're walking back in history about 1,500 years.
Reliving history is the focus of a fair at a nearby park where Scottish, Basque, and Peruvian musicians celebrate the different cultures of the immigrant herders who, over the years, spent spring, summer, and fall tending sheep here. People like 79-year-old Cotton Wiley, a man of Scottish heritage whose piercing blue eyes laugh as he invites me to climb up into a sheep herder's wagon.
Get up in there.
This narrow wooden wagon with an arched canvas top has a bed, cupboard, collapsible table, and a tiny wood-burning stove, just like the sheep herder wagon Cotton lived in back in the 1930s and 40s.
They didn't make them to be comfortable. They wanted you to stay out with the sheep and work, not be in the camp enjoying it.
But Cotton Wiley loved the life and the food.
Yes, ma'am, I've ate a lot of lamb, and it's good meat, real good. In fact, that's all a sheep herder ever had to eat, you know, was lamb, and you'd kill one and hang him in the tree at night and then put him in the back of the wagon. There's an open place back there underneath the bed. Roll it in a blanket or a tarp and then put it in under the bed. And believe it or not, he'd stay cool in there all day. Then hang him back in the tree at night and he'd last till you ate him up.
Eating lamb is what this festival, now in its fourth year, celebrates. I follow my nose across the park where the women of St. Charles Catholic Church continue a 50-year-old tradition, serving local lamb prepared in the traditional Basque fashion. In the 1930s, Basque people, fleeing persecution by Spain's fascist dictator Francisco Franco, came to Idaho and found work herding sheep. Rose Mallory's mom ran a boarding house here for Basque sheep herders and started what became the annual lamb dinner. More than 100 people had already eaten by the time Rose took me through the tantalizing food line.
This is called Spanish rice or Basque rice, and it's made with chorizos and ham and pimientos and rice and chicken broth. That's the roast lamb, roast leg of lamb, and it's garlic and marinated the day before we cook it. We cook about 20 lambs for this dinner.
While the lamb dinner and other Basque traditions remain strong here, few Basque still work as sheep herders. Most moved on to become business and political leaders. Ranchers like John Peavy, who owns the Flat Top Sheep Company, must look elsewhere for sheep herders.
We have almost all Peruvian herders right now, and they're wonderful men.
Why Peruvians?
It depends on where the economy probably is the worst. That's where these people are willing to pull up stakes and go halfway around the world and work in a foreign land.
Peavy's foreman, Peruvian Juan Gamara, has worked here the past 7 years.
Ahorita estoy ganando como gana un doctor en Perú.
Gamara says he earns as much here as a doctor makes in Peru. He sends his earnings home to Peru, a mountainous country where sheep are raised as much for their wool as for their meat. Kamada likes Idaho, but prefers the taste of Peruvian lamb, saying it's fresher.
En Perú el sabor es más sabroso.
And his favorite way to prepare lamb? Barbecued.
Al común es barbecue. The lambs.
Idaho's Trailing of the Sheep Festival has become so popular that Peruvian barbecue and local lamb recipes are popping up in Sun Valley restaurants year-round. For The Splendid Table, I'm Jill Hoyt in Ketchum, Idaho.
And we thought Sun Valley was only skiing and hoo-ha celebrities. Lines are officially open and you can phone us. The number is 800-537-5252. We will talk. Questions, comments, gripes, everything's fair game today. Let's get right to it. We've got Jamily on the line. So, Jamily, what's on your mind?
I would like to know what we can do with fresh lingon berries. I have a grower in my area that has them at the farmer's market and also available all year round.
Where do you live that you're getting fresh lingon berries?
I live in Southwest Washington.
Oh, you live in Nirvana. I mean, people in Washington State can get all, and it's also in Oregon, you can get all kinds of great stuff. Have you tasted the lingon berry at this point?
Yes, I have. They're wonderful.
What do they taste like?
Kind of like a sweeter cranberry. I've used them, made jam out of them. I've also used them just to cook as a sauce over pancakes and things like that.
Mm-hmm. You know, they're used so much in Scandinavian cooking. And I would say any place that you can use a red currant, if you look at recipes, you generally can use a lingonberry. A lingonberry is just a bit sweeter. But here's one idea for you. And we used to do this when we were living in Europe and we could get fresh currants. We did this, and it occurs to me lingonberries would be great. Do a sweet tart red wine sauce with them that you then could use to make pan sauces for almost anything from grilled salmon, you know, to poultry, to pork. And what I would do is I'd take the lingonberries and I would simmer them in red wine with something like allspice and a few slices of fresh ginger and maybe even a little piece of chili. You don't want it hot. You want it to have a sparkle to it. And you'd add a bit of sugar to that. And essentially, you're making kind of the syrup that you made to put over the pancakes, but it's not going to be as sweet because the red wine will give it a nice depth and dimension and a hint of tartness to it. And then when you have that, you can freeze it or put it in the fridge. And then let's say you do a sautéed piece of salmon, okay?
Uh-huh.
You throw a little bit of that syrup into the pan to cook up all the crusty bits. And you maybe add a teeny bit of broth to that, and you've got a wonderful sweet-sour sauce.
Oh, that sounds good.
And it'll just be packed with fruit. And then you can garnish the plate. If you've got any more fresh lingonberries around, you can garnish the plate with the fresh lingonberries.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other thing you can do is you can freeze them the way you would freeze any berry, which is just put them on a baking sheet. Maybe put some wax paper on a baking sheet and mm-hmm. spread the lingonberries on the baking sheet. Put them in the freezer, and once they're frozen hard, just pop them into a plastic bag. And then you can pull them out and make anything you want with them whenever you want.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah. So try that red wine lingonberry syrup, a sweet sour syrup. It'll be very good with anything like pork or ham over the holidays, game, that kind of thing.
Okie dokie.
Okay?
Thank
and
you
enjoy.
Very much. Will do. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. It's time for our trivia question of the week. And this is a tough one. It comes from the region of Western France called Normandy. The question is, what is a Norman hole, or in French, the Trou Normand? I can give you one clue. It does tie into Thanksgiving.
We'll be back with that answer in a moment and more of your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We're taking your calls this hour. The number is 800-537-5252. But before getting back to the phones, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. It comes from the Normandy region of France, and it does apply to Thanksgiving. The question is, what is a Norman hole? Well, the traditional way people in Normandy get through big, rich meals, and they love to eat big, rich meals, is the Norman hole. Now, you should know that Normandy produces some of France's best cream, best butter, the seafood's unbelievable, and the pork is to die for. Eating light does not fly in Normandy. The Norman hole makes room for more. It works this way. You get to maybe course number 3 of a 6 or 7 course meal, and you know you are not going to make it. So you sit back from the table, take a deep breath, and chug-a-lug some Calvados, usually young Calvados, the really fiery stuff. Calvados is an apple brandy. It's close to America's Applejack. The idea is that the alcohol opens up a hole. It makes room for more. Then you get back down to the business of eating. And it does work. Now, Normandy's not only a place to eat well. The apple cider is some of the best in the world. The scenery's out of a storybook. And the town of Ville-de-les-Poils has been copper pot heaven since the 1300s. Antique copper is pricey here, but new copper goes for a song. One tip. Before buying, check out the Copper Pot Museum. It's going to help you understand what makes a quality pot. So that's the village of Ville-de-les-Poils, and maybe you'll experience a Norman hole firsthand. Okay, let's get back to the phones. We're taking your calls this hour. The number is 800-537-5252. Let's talk. Let's see who's up. We've got Charlotte on the phone. So, Charlotte, tell me what pressing thing is on your mind at this moment.
Lynn, we are doing Thanksgiving dinner at about 8,000 feet this year at a cabin up in the mountains. And what I need from you is some advice. I need you to let your imagination run wild and help me put something together that's kickback but festive and wonderful.
Oh, this sounds great. Where is the cabin? Where's the cabin?
Up in the hills in Wyoming, up in the mountains.
Oh, this sounds like one of those picture book magazine Thanksgiving things.
It is. It's beautiful. And the friends that we're with, our dear friends, will have 4 adults and 4 kids. We're planning to do the turkey on a covered, you know, a kettle grill.
Right. Okay. But have you done that before?
I've done them in the summertime. I've never done them in the winter.
Well, the only difference is going to be you're probably going to need to refresh the charcoal a bit more because it's going to be cold.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's and you know, it's about 15, 20 minutes a pound, and you keep banking the coals against the side of the kettle and all that business.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we thought we'd try it as something kind of different and fun. Now, that puts some challenges together, and this is not the kind of dinner that you call out grandma's china for. So I kind of thought maybe you'd have some good ideas on something that we could put together that was kind of fun.
Is there a cook stove in the cabin?
There is.
Is it a wood
stove? And there's a refrigerator and water and all that
stuff. All right. You know what would be wonderful to do because it's such an easy thing is a really great vegetable slaw. A coleslaw. You don't have to cook anything or whatever, and you can use good commercial mayonnaise and a bit of sour cream and a little garlic and some celery salt and toss that all together with some vinegar, you know, to taste.
Oh.
And just put it in the fridge. And with that hot turkey off the grill, it'll be great. And the other great thing you could do, do you have a fireplace?
Uh-huh.
Why don't you try wrapping sweet potatoes in foil and cooking them in the embers of the fireplace?
Oh, now that's a wonderful idea, because one of the things I'm thinking about is, you know, the regular turkey and gravy and mashed potatoes and stuff is tough when you're doing it on a grill.
Well, that's right, but if you do your potatoes, you could do white potatoes the same way and have on the table maybe a pot of melted butter that you've melted with cinnamon and black pepper and salt, and that becomes the spice butter that you put into the hot potatoes.
Oh, so you don't need a gravy thing.
Yeah.
Beautiful melted butter there that's seasoned a little bit for the sweet potatoes and salt and pepper for the white potatoes.
That's right. And then the other thing you could do, and you could have some sour cream for the white potatoes, too, if you feel like. I mean, you know, it is Thanksgiving. But you could have a drip pan under that turkey. And if you put some water in that drip pan, you won't burn the juices. And then from that drip pan, you could make a little bit of a gravy if you wanted to.
Yeah, there'd be enough there that you could do something with.
Yeah, and the other trick, you know, with making great turkey gravy is take the neck and the giblets and that kind of thing and put them in a saucepan with celery, carrot, onion. And then what I do is I add half white wine, half water to cover everything, and a lot of garlic in there, by the way. And then I let that simmer while the turkey cooks. And then I strain it and boil it down to it's really dense in flavor, and that gets mixed up with the pan juices. So you get a nice, you know, lovely
extra flavor with
exactly, that. Exactly. So that kind of launches you on the way.
Oh, that sounds like those are fun ideas. I would never in a million years would have thought of doing a vegetable coleslaw kind of thing for Thanksgiving dinner.
But I think it'd be lovely. It'd be a nice crunchy contrast to everything else that you've got.
It would be, and I love the idea about doing potatoes on the fire.
Yeah, I think, and you know, the other thing is maybe you should try getting an old-fashioned popcorn popper and pop popcorn after dinner.
Oh, that's a traditional kind of thing.
Exactly. You got it. Exactly. It could
really
be great.
Wonderful.
Okay, hey, enjoy. It sounds like a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Oh, I think it will be. Thanks for your help.
Take care, Charlotte.
Bye-bye.
You know, there's one other thing I should have mentioned to Charlotte. Some dried cranberries added to that slaw would just be perfect. The color would be great and the flavor would be great. Mary's on the line. So, Mary, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about fried turkeys. I have had them in restaurants. I have never cooked them, but I like them very much. I would like to know, however, if you can just do a breast that way. The reason for my concern is that I think having the meat surrounded by the skin is important when you're frying it, and in a breast you just have it across the top, not the bottom.
Well, the real key with frying is it tends to seal in juices, so you could do it with a breast. But I've got good news for you and I've got bad news.
Okay.
We had John Martin Taylor on the show a while ago, and John is the guy who started this whole deep-fried turkey deal. And he's a wonderful cook. He's down south, and here's the deal. Whether you're doing a turkey breast or you're doing a whole turkey, you really need a special apparatus and you need to do it outside.
Okay.
It's just too dangerous to do it inside.
Yeah.
And I mean, unless you're talking about a turkey breast that's 2 pounds and that you could do in a standard deep fryer, which I think you're talking about something bigger, right?
I was talking about something bigger, and but I did wonder if it was smaller, if it could be done inside. I don't mind doing it outside. It's just that to do a whole turkey, I've seen estimates anywhere from 10 to 20 gallons of oil that you need, and that's an awful lot.
Well, John, now I'm trying to remember, because John and I have had this discussion over the past couple of months, because we're thinking about doing this. And what he's suggesting is 2 gallons of oil, a 5-gallon pot, 2 gallons of oil for a 5-pound breast.
Oh, that's good.
But the problem is you've got to have the place to heat up the oil outside.
I can do that.
You can do you have a big burner?
Yes.
Oh, that's...
Well, the local hardware rents the apparatus.
You
the turkey
where
cookie.
Where
cookie.
Mary, where do you live?
Well, right now I'm in Michigan, but I'd be doing this over the holidays in Florida. And at the local hardware, which is a national chain, they rent many types of tools, including turkey cookers.
That's great. You can rent a turkey cooker. Okay,
right.
You're in business. Here's what you're going to do.
Okay.
You need a deep fat frying thermometer.
Yes.
Okay. You need an instant reading thermometer.
Okay.
All right. You need about 2 gallons of oil.
All right.
All right. 5-pound breast of turkey.
Yes.
And what you want to do is get the oil to about 375 degrees.
Okay.
Okay. And you've got to have some way, like a basket lining your 5-gallon pot,
mm-hmm.
some way of very gently lowering that turkey into the oil. Because if you drop it, I think you know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And by the way, don't do this in shorts, no matter how hot it is outside, and wear old shoes.
Okay.
So in case
all
you have
good ideas.
Yeah, and keep
no sandals.
No sandals and no kids and no pets.
Okay.
You know, I know this sounds like I'm setting you up, you know, to start a war, but you've really got to be careful because it's hot fat.
Yep.
So, you gently lower the turkey in its basket
mm-hmm.
into that and you figure 5 minutes to the pound maximum.
5 minutes. Okay.
Right. So, if it's 5 pounds, it's about 25 minutes. And then you lift it out gently. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you can test it by stick the instant reading thermometer in there.
Mm-hmm.
And you want about 170 to 180 degrees in the center of the breast.
Okay.
And keep the oil at around no lower than 340.
Okay, as it'll lower it with the cold heat being put in.
And
there.
That's why you want to have that thermometer kind of stuck there, you know, clipped to the side of the pot so you can be reading it and seeing. And, you know, adjust the heat accordingly.
Now, should I roll the breast to try to tuck all the fat around?
Nah.
That's not necessary.
No way. Just make sure that it's dry.
Okay.
You could put a little seasoning like salt and pepper or whatever under the skin, but just make sure it's dry because obviously you put something wet into hot fat and
it's going to splatter.
It's going to, But I'm still so in love with your hardware store at the moment. I can't tell you.
I wish I could remember the name of the chain, but I can't. But it's a national chain, and they, as a matter of course, rent tools, and it's wonderful.
We can all check our local hardware
stores,
find out they do it too. We can pressure them into it. So that's the deal. Just be really careful.
Okay, I will, and thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Obviously, this is the day for turkey calls. And if you haven't tried this idea of deep frying the turkey, you do need the special apparatus and you have to do it outside. But it is the most succulent bird you could imagine. And it cooks fast, 5 minutes more or less to the pound. Speaking of turkey, stuffing comes to mind. And my favorite is cornbread. Now, when I think cornbread, I think Southern cooking. You know, cornbread, ham, biscuits. Well, we have an interesting take for you to mull while eating your feast. Historian Elizabeth Engelhart grew up in Appalachia. For her, cornbread and biscuits, well, they're more than good eating. And she says, I quote, "In the Appalachia area of the South, recipes for biscuits and cornbread hide a social history of gender, race, and class." Elizabeth Engelhart, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
So what is so revealing about these two breads, cornbread and biscuit?
At the turn of the century, there was a real difference between the two recipes. When someone in Appalachia sat down and thought, should I cook cornbread or should I cook biscuits, they were actually making some decisions about class membership and what it meant to be a proper woman. Let's talk for just a minute about what kind of biscuits we're talking about. The beaten biscuits were heralded by activists who came to Appalachia. These were women who were college educated. They came from the Northeast or they came from other parts of the South, and they had a very strong idea that they wanted to help the women in Appalachia. They brought with them a recipe, and the recipe they brought was for beaten biscuits. And this wasn't a recipe where you beat something with a whisk. This was a recipe where you actually take out a mallet and you hit the dough. One recipe I found said that you hit it 300 times for family, but you might want to hit it 500 times for special guests.
This sounds really time-consuming.
It really was. When you sit down and you think about the differences between the two recipes, to make those beaten biscuits, you had to spend a lot of time in your house. You had to watch the oven. You had to hit it those 300 strokes or those 500 strokes. And I tried that, by the way. That took me a while. Oftentimes, what that implied was that this is a recipe that works best for a woman who has servants, someone who doesn't have to spend her own time, but in fact is using somebody else's time. There's some evidence that the beaten biscuit recipe, in fact, came from some of the Low Country South. That means that this recipe is, in fact, tied up with the racial politics of the South at the turn of the century. I was reading back through for, in another context, Zora Neale Hurston's book, Their Eyes Were Watching God. And in fact, there's a moment in that book where we find out that the main character's grandmother has to go to her employer because it's beaten biscuit day. She has to go and cook those biscuits. Cornbread, on the other hand, could be made in between working. You could run home and whip up the cornbread pretty fast. You didn't have to watch it in the same way. And you didn't have to change the style of your life. If you were someone who was used to working outside, if you were someone who was used to going a lot of different places, you could still do that and provide cornbread for your family. You didn't have to stay inside the house and be that kind of domestic woman to make the cornbread.
Why did they insist they make biscuits? Why not just accept the fact these people had cornbread?
It's a good question. It's something I've done a lot of thinking about. A lot of these activists were progressive women. They were women who bought into ideas of domesticity, into ideas of hygiene. And to them, making biscuits, which was a recipe that they recognized, a recipe they were comfortable with, a recipe that perhaps they made in their own families, I think their logic was that if I see this Appalachian woman making biscuits, she must have adopted some of the other values that I recognize as well. Ideas about womanhood, about hygiene, about domesticity.
What about today in Appalachia? I mean, is the biscuit viewed as sort of the upper class and the cornbread as common, in big quotation marks?
You know, I was thinking about my family. I'm from Appalachia, and I'm from a long line of Appalachian cooks. When I think about our Christmas celebration in my family, my grandmother, born in North Carolina, lived in North Carolina her whole life, makes us a big pan of biscuits. Now, for New Year's, my mother makes cornbread. I make cornbread. And that's a part of the New Year's celebration. So I think that at this point in Appalachia, both of the recipes are thought of as regional food.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Elizabeth Engelhardt is visiting assistant professor with the Women's Study Program at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio. Speaking of cornbread, as I said, it makes great turkey stuffing. I've got a favorite recipe we use every year. It's called Herman's Cornbread Stuffing, and it's a bit on the Baroque side, which is logical if you knew Herman. He was quite a piece of work. You can get the recipe on our website. That's splendidtable.org. Well, we're out of time for today. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Have a great Thanksgiving, and give us a call. Anytime, the number's 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with some sound advice on dieting from Beth Barnes. She says, what you eat standing up doesn't count. The Splendid Table is brought to you by the kitchenware area at Target, where you'll find a complete assortment of fondue sets, including the Farberware Commercial Fondue, featuring an 1810 stainless steel fondue pot, jewel-tone color-coded forks, and black ceramic ramekins. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. And while you're visiting, be sure to take a look at the Splendid Table store. It's full of the things I like to have in my kitchen. It's on our website, splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. The theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Bakely Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.